Hello, I'm Peter Clark. Welcome to Inside Media at Inside Story. This time, the new fact-checking unit at the ABC. At the beginning of 2013, the ABC's Director of News, Kate Tawney, announced a funding boost from the federal government of $10 million to the ABC's news-gathering firepower. She indicated then that some of that money would be used to hire more journalists, especially in regional areas, and to establish a fact-checking unit within the ABC's news division. That unit went live on air and online, seemingly a little late out of the starting blocks, halfway through the second week of the 2013 federal election campaign. The unit had a difficult gestation. Veteran journalist Russell Skelton was appointed as the editor of the FCU. The ABC's managing director, Mark Scott, was forced to vigorously defend that hiring in front of the Senate Estimates Committee when the coalition Senate leader, Erica Betts, attacked the ABC and Skelton for what he claimed were the journalist's biased posts on Twitter. The unit's launch was delayed, despite the start of the federal election, by the inevitable practical preparations, according to Skelton. But it did leave the election fact-checking field wide open to the ABC's main Australian fact-checking competitors, the USA-derived franchise PolitiFact, and the Conversations fact-checking unit, headed up by former Sunday Age editor Gay Elkhorn. The ABC's outfit is much better resourced than its rivals, of course, and will presumably, over the next months, establish itself within the ABC's overall news and current affairs culture and Australia's news media ecosystem more broadly. The national broadcaster runs a very large taxpayer-funded news machine that feeds its 24/7 output via many media forms and platforms and across a vast land area. The ABC's central newsroom in Sydney is currently going through a fundamental transformation, both in its physical layout and procedurally, to meet the intense demands of the digital revolution, including that 24/7 news expectation. How the new venture fares in the estimation of its citizen consumers within the contentious setting of an election and in the longer term post-election remains to be seen. John Barron is the face and the voice of the new ABC fact-checking unit. You may have heard him on news radio or seen him on the television program Planet America, playing the straight newsman to Chas Licciardello's comedic contrarian, or perhaps read his blogs. Just before Kevin Rudd announced the 2013 election date, Inside Story caught up with John via Skype at his FCU desk in the ABC's Sydney headquarters. ABC News and current affairs workers have been evolving as multimedia, multi-platform journalists and producers for some time. But John Barron describes the new fact-checking unit as embodying that historic shift completely.
The fact-checking unit is the first of a new generation for the ABC where it is multimedia, multi-platform. So rather than in the old days, you know, you'd start off at the ABC and you were a radio journalist or you were a TV journalist. Everybody that works for the fact-checking unit, as is the case with those that are also working in the new regional bureaus and so on, are working to all media outlets at once. So when we're producing a fact check, we're thinking about how it's going to appear on our website, and that's typically going to be a 300 to 500 word print article boiling down the nuts and bolts of a particular issue. But we're also going to be thinking about how we're going to package this up for the 7 p.m. news. So we might be looking at doing a 90-second or 1 minute stand-up report with a whole lot of explaining graphics and so on to really give people a sense of an issue. It might also be a Q&A like you and I are doing for ABC News Radio or Radio National or one of the many local radio stations the ABC has around the country. So there are plenty of different ways of delivering this information, and all of it will be under the ABC Fact Check brand. It might be something that follows on from a news story. So take last week where we had the Bradley Manning verdict in the United States, and we would have a long form report, maybe 2.5 minutes from the ABC's Washington Bureau, Ben Knight or Lisa Miller might have filed the main package on the Bradley Manning verdict. And then following on from that, we might do a fact check which is based on reaction to that story. A comment that Julian Assange made, WikiLeaks founder, Australian senatorial candidate, In reacting to the Manning case, he said Barack Obama has launched a war on whistleblowers. He's indicted more whistleblowers on espionage charges than all other American presidents combined. Now, that sounds like a pretty remarkable statement. You think, Barack Obama, that nice, hopey, changey guy, is he really launching a war on whistleblowers? Has he really issued twice as many indictments as all other presidents combined? So we look at that fact. We drill down into it. You look at all of the indictments that have been issued since the Espionage Act of 1917 came in to see whether, in fact, Julian Assange was telling the truth. But also, it's not simply just a matter of saying, is that right or wrong? But it's also a matter of putting that into context. And is the claim sustained that this is a war on whistleblowers or a war on journalists, as Assange was alleging? So those are the kinds of things that we're wanting to do. Inform people's understanding of an issue, as well as you know, pinning down a particular claim or assertion that's made by a public figure.
Let's come back to that in a moment, John, because I want to explore your method. But we're going to be using the word fact over and over again in this conversation. You just used it a couple of times. So can we just come to some agreement on what is a fact? And I'm going to quote to you from a book called A History in the Modern Fact by a woman called Mary Poovey. What are facts? Are they incontrovertible data that simply demonstrate what is true? Or are they bits of evidence marshalled to persuade others of the theory one sets out with? Do facts somehow exist in the world like pebbles waiting to be picked up? Or are they manufactured and thus informed by all the social and personal factors that go into every act of human creation? Are facts beyond interpretation, or are they the very stuff of interpretation, its symptomatic incarnation instead of the place where it begins? So those two metaphors, one about the pebble, autonomous, sealed, you can pick it up and it's there, it's a fact, or the process of creating a fact. How do you see it?
I feel as though I've been sent back magically to first year philosophy lectures, I think, Peter. It is, at beyond a certain point, it does get into debates over the nature of truth. And you can very easily, in trying to check a fact, in inverted commas, you can get into some very sort of regressive and semantic arguments. And yes, it's true to a point that all facts can be contested, but our job is to present the facts and to allow people that are consuming this content, watching the segments, reading the articles, to draw their own conclusions. Are these facts persuasive or not? That's something that we can leave up to people. We're not in the business of saying that this is true, this is untrue, unless it is demonstrably so. But in many, many cases, it's much more nuanced than that. So our verdicts, our findings are probably going to be a little more complex, perhaps, but hopefully just as useful, if not more so, than some of the other people that are out there in this field now.
From what you're saying, then, you're offering the ABC consumer a process and a body of extra information, if you like, extra data and interpretation, perhaps, as part of that package, and leave it to them. Is that what you're saying?
Well, not necessarily the interpretation part. That's where we obviously have to be very careful with the ABC. We're not wanting to appear to be taking a stance. We have to be very careful and measured in the language that we use and what inferences might be drawn from that. But essentially, if we can, in 1 minute or a minute and a half, provide just a couple of key bits of information, whether you call them just information or facts or nuggets of evidence or however you want to characterize them, if you can produce those things enough to have somebody look at a particular debate in a slightly different way, it might be presenting them with a statistic about vaccination rates in Australia amongst kids under the age of 5 being below the vaccination rates in Rwanda and Iran, for instance. That suddenly changes the way people look at an issue such as vaccination. We're not taking a stand on the issue. We're not issuing an opinion on whether people should have their kids vaccinated or not. But we're just saying the fact is, if you look at the World Health Organization data on vaccination rates between Australia and a number of other countries that we would think that we had better public health standards than, you can find that we're lagging behind. Make of that what you will, but those are facts.
You've seen a lot of the commentary already, John, I'm sure, and Bronwyn Clune, for example, recently in The Guardian. Tim Dunlop also wrote a commentary piece asking that basic question, and you see it reflected in social media all the time, particularly about the ABC. Why aren't they just reporting the facts? What does this say about the rest of the ABC journalistic output if the fact-checking unit is doing this extra work? Can we trust as much the rest of the output, or do we trust the fact-checking unit more than the rest of the journalists?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, Peter. I mean, a lot of my colleagues here at the ABC will sort of say, well, what have we got a fact-checking unit for? Well, that's what journalists do. We check facts. I guess the way I'd characterise it is, as a journalist, you are checking the facts that go into your story. As a fact-checker, the facts are the story. There's an important difference. We're drilling down on a single point, analysing it in a short amount of time. That's not to replace what Lateline does or 7:30 does or the 7 o'clock news does or ABC local radio does. They're all doing different stories in different ways for different platforms and different audiences often. What we're doing is simply focusing in, laser-like we hope, on a particular issue, a particular statement, a particular assertion, and saying, what can we tell you about this? And we've got, fortunately, because of the money that's been allocated for this new unit, we've got a lot of expertise coming in, not just journalistic, but we've got people that come from a legal research background, finance background, people that are database specialists that can frankly make a lot more sense of a graph or a pie chart than I can coming from a purely journalistic background, Peter. So it's really important that we can draw a distinction and say we're not here to check the facts of our colleagues. We're not like Media Watch. That's not our role. But we are here to put to the test public statements, public assertions, claims that are out there and see, is this correct? Is this not correct? What information can we give you so you can make up your own mind?
It's not hard to imagine, though, a scenario, John, is it, where one of your colleagues, as a regular journalist, puts a story out there, governed by the rules of narrative, governed by the rules of fact-checking within that journalistic exercise, but when your group of experts in the fact-checking unit really drill down, it may reveal some flaws there in that work. Is that possible?
It certainly is. And it's something that we, as we're still getting our passwords sorted out and our phones connected and building the website from the ground up and so on and putting this all together, it's one of the questions that we have yet to need to confront, I suppose, but no doubt we will. If we are checking a particular fact from a public figure, that fact check is going to run off the back of a report that uses that quote from that public figure. What should the protocol be there? Should we be putting in a call to our colleagues upstairs in the newsroom and say, oh, you know what so-and-so said about this? Actually, we've found that that's not true. So should we be telling them to leave that out of their report? Or should we be just running our fact check off the back of that report and say, well, actually, that is untrue? Does that therefore reflect negatively on our journalistic colleagues in news and current affairs? So there's a really interesting area there that we're going to have to feel our way through.
What you're confronting there is one of the central paradoxes of contemporary journalism, particularly the he said, she said style of journalism, which strives for some sort of semblance of balance. Both those comments could be factually incorrect. If one side of the partisan politics says, as we're seeing at the moment with asylum seekers very clearly, claims, counterclaims, so the entire output of a story could be questionable factually.
Indeed, it could be. And this is where a nuanced approach is important, and also not to step over that line. You know, one of the limitations, I would say, Peter, that exists with some of the metrics that are used, the truth-o-meter that PolitiFact in the United States and here in Australia use as well, there is a temptation to, in doing a fact check, to perhaps try and find facts that you can check that will prove to be untrue, that will prove to be pants on fire, because, well, it's kind of more eye-catching. You know, it's a little bit more sensational than coming up with something that says, oh, it's mostly true, or, you know, this is sustained by the evidence or whatever. There is a temptation there, and we're going to be working very hard not to fall into that trap.
What will be the form of your verdict? You're not using Pinocchio noses or partly true, mostly true, mostly false. You use the word nuance too. Are you trying a different approach to that?
Yeah, we are. We, on the one hand, of course, you know, when people watch the movie show with Margaret and David, they want to know how many stars they give the movie at the end of their review, but they also want to hear the review. Mm. So, it's important to have some form of meaningful metric that helps you to sum up your conclusions on this, the facts that you've presented. But we're not going to limit ourselves to maybe four categories, five categories. Our intention, Peter, is really to choose a couple of words, a phrase, or maybe just one word that sums up where we've arrived at after analysing the issue, and we could end up with a limitless number of potential verdicts, because if we're not providing people with enough to help them get through that he said, she said false equivalency that we so often see, then we're probably not doing our job.
What do you see then as the nexus or the relationship probably between truth, which is something that we have a deep ideological commitment to in journalism, and the facts as we're talking about them? You're probably aware of that famous Bertolt Brecht experiment, 10 people watching a car accident, each with a different version of exactly what happened, the factual or actual occurrence in that car accident. That's something we deal with every day, memory, perceptions, recollection. When fact-checkers go to speak to people down the track from perhaps the first reporter, they confront that as well. What is the connection, in your view as a journalist and within the fact-checking unit, between truth, an abstract idea, perhaps an ideal, and facts?
Well, this is getting very philosophical, I suppose. I mean, look, from my first day as a journalist, I assumed that this was all the dream of a dog. None of it was real, and that stood me in very good stead. It explains an awful lot about media and politics in Australia, Peter. But look, let me talk you through the process, I suppose. It is important to identify if something is checkable, is fact-checkable. So our process is we arrive in the morning, 9 o'clock, we sit down, just as journalists have in newsrooms all around the world for generations. We sit around a table, all the team are there, and we say, who's got what for me? You're pitching stories. You're saying, well, I saw this or I heard this. This was on Radio National this morning. This is on Sky News last night. Or do you see this in the Fin this morning? That's really interesting. I think we might be able to check that out. They pitch it to our editor, just as you would a news story at a newspaper or the TV news bulletin editor. You kick the story around. You say, well, how can we actually approach this? This is an interesting issue. We don't know what is right and what is wrong about this, but is there something that we can actually focus in on? A claim, a particular statistic, an assertion where the language maybe seems to cross sort of the threshold of what is actually sustained by the evidence and goes into the realm of exaggeration. We start to sort of test those boundaries. And then if we think that there's something to it, the researcher, the journalist will get to work. They'll start looking at the relevant sources of information, be that databases, be that starting with a bit of Googling, or be that going through the clippings file, etc. They'll put together a research brief. And at that point, they should be in a position to say, we can actually test this fact. This isn't just somebody expressing an opinion, which is entirely subjective, and they're entitled to express an opinion. Well, whether you agree with the opinion or not, it's an opinion, it exists. But are they making a claim of fact that is true or untrue? Is that surprising either way? And does this matter? Who cares? Will people read this, see this, and say, ah, that's really interesting, I didn't know that, whichever way it falls? Or will they go, yes, yeah, so what? So there are all of these important tests that we have to put a fact check through before we even start writing it. And then we start the process of delivering the fact check across our various platforms.
Let's stay internal for a moment with your colleagues, journalists. For example, let's just take one, Chris Yorman, who writes quite opinionated pieces, for example, for The Drum. He works from deep knowledge. I assume that he does an enormous amount of fact-checking and cross-checking with people. But at the end of the day, he does place an interpretation, melding together his deeper knowledge, his observations, and his fact-checking. It gets quite mixed, doesn't it? It gets quite tricky and very nuanced. When I was speaking to Kate Tawney recently, I asked her about opinion and the role of opinion from journalists like Chris Yorman, and she said, of course, fact-based, well-informed opinion. Can you disentangle some of that for us? You've used the word opinion, and all of the ABC journalists use opinion to some degree, to a greater or lesser degree, depending on what department they're working for. How do you see that mix of opinion, analysis, and what we're talking about today, facts?
Well, yeah, look, I guess, you know, to an extent it can be splitting hairs, but in a lot of cases, I think in most cases, the ABC will actually say that what people like Chris Yulman or others are providing, ABC employees, for the Drum website is not opinion, it is informed analysis.
Yes.
Now, you might contend that, in fact, oh, this lapses into opinion. Well, that's typically something that we are required by the ABC's editorial policies to avoid. So this is something that everybody who works at the ABC is mindful of. It's compulsory to vote in this country. People do form opinions of political parties. They do have personal preferences. They may be socially progressive, fiscally conservative. That's the profile of a lot of journalists. That may or may not become evident in their analysis of stories. Some people on the right always look at the ABC and they say, look, the ABC, it's a bunch of lefties. There was that study that came out, which I think had a sample size of about 40, that said, you know, there's a huge number, vote for the Greens, etc. The fact is, people do have private opinions, but our jobs require us, our future employment is dependent on the fact that our personal views don't colour our professional work, our journalism, our analysis of the facts. So this is one of those things that every journalist since the day Dot has had to contend with if they're working for an outlet such as the ABC, which requires you to be unbiased, impartial, non-partisan, and yet draw on what you know. And it does get into interesting areas where journalists of long, long standing have to say, am I too close to this issue? Have I become too friendly with a certain politician who's now become leader of the opposition or prime minister? Am I giving them a bit of a free kick because I personally like them, whereas I personally dislike somebody else? You know, that becomes an issue if you're working on a particular round, a particular beat. Stockholm syndrome can kind of kick in if you're at state parliament for 10 years and suddenly you're treated like a terrific person because you've known this premier since they were a backbencher and you've been to their house and you've met their husband and their kids, etc., etc. These are all pitfalls and traps that that every working journalist has to contend with, has to question themselves, and we'll have to continue to do that. We'll have to make sure that any sort of personal views aren't informing who we go after with a fact check. Who are we going to, you know, who's this? Are we just doing this because this politician annoys me and I want to pin them? You know, I want to shut them. I want to stop them saying this thing. They keep saying this thing. I want to stop them saying it by actually proving it's untrue. We have to be very careful of all of that. But I'm confident that the editorial policies that the ABC has in place are more than adequate at making sure that that doesn't happen.
And John, listening to you say that, I also think of the imperatives of storytelling itself. When you forging a great yarn, there are a couple of linchpin facts, aren't there, or bedrock facts that make the whole story come together or really give it legs. That's a very strong influence on journalists as well, isn't it, the getting caught up in the storytelling process?
Oh, you bet. It's very, very easy, which is why we discovered quite early on when starting to put together a research brief to do a fact check, you have to put the quote or the phrase or the premise, whatever it is that you are checking. You want to put that at the top of your Word document and you want to keep looking at it. And every bit of information that you assemble, every phone call you make, every quote you get from an expert, every bit of data that you assemble has to be to do with that or it's out. Now, it doesn't mean that you don't sort of keep a separate file that you accumulate all of this other useful information to the next time you look at this particular subject. Maybe you decide at some point, you know what, actually, that's not so interesting, but this really is. That can evolve as well. And as we've already found in this unit, sometimes we start looking at a particular issue and we say, you know what, this isn't so much a fact check as this is a news story. And we'll then call up our colleagues at the PM program or at Late Line or 7:30 or whoever it is and say, guys, we've just come across this, or this FOI has just come in, and I think it's something that could be more useful for you than for us. So we've already become a source for the rest of the ABC in initiating, uncovering potential stories as well as checking those facts. Who knows, if we do our jobs right, and this, as a lot of people suspect, becomes a major part of the future of journalism, this style of not just fact-checking, but data journalism, computer-assisted journalism, spreadsheet journalism, this sort of in-depth analysis, if it becomes as powerful and effective as we anticipate it will into the future, then we may well become that sort of an engine room of news content production for the wider organisation.
You may have caught Amelia Lester, who's now managing editor of The New Yorker, Sydney-born and started out as a fact-checker at The New Yorker, now managing editor. She talks about 17 fact-checkers and debates and cross-checking and challenging each other. And they even fact-checked the cartoons. They apparently picked up one that had more than 140 characters in a tweet that was depicted in a cartoon. They had to fix that up. They even fact-checked the poetry so things aren't wrong. Do you see The New Yorker in some ways quite an idealized gold standard in the whole area of fact-checking?
Well, in many ways, I guess what the New Yorker used to be able to do, and what a lot of the old established masthead newspapers in the United States, in particular, used to be able to do, was to have that extra editorial layer that made sure that everything they did was absolutely right. Unfortunately, of course, you look at the number of newspaper journalists in the United States now; it's been cut by almost 50% in the last decade. That has meant a diminution of quality. It has also come at a time, of course, when there's an increased demand to not just be filing for a deadline at 9 o'clock tonight for tomorrow morning's edition of the newspaper, but they want you filing for 3 o'clock this afternoon so it can get out on the website before the spike in traffic that comes at about 5 p.m. when people log on to their iPads as they're on the subway home in New York. So deadlines have changed. The amount of the demand for content has increased. The number of people producing that content, of course, has been cut dramatically. And those are just the journalists. Those who are in the quality control, the old sub-editor's desk and so on, is looking a bit thin, as we know in this country. Sub-editor's desks in some cases have been outsourced to New Zealand. This is an issue, and I guess it's no coincidence that the rise in fact-checking units such as ours is happening at a time when the rest of the media, newspaper journalism and news magazines in particular, don't have those resources to do that anymore.
Can we talk about images? Because I guess you and I have been really thinking about words so far, haven't we? And statements and things printed and documents. What about images? Mm. That's a very fraught area, isn't it? Particularly these days when we get phone vision from perhaps some trouble spot in the Middle East. Always very difficult. I know that Al Jazeera uses geo software to triangulate and work out exactly where some images may have come from. Do you see that as part of your remit to actually verify images as well?
Yeah, that's an interesting area. I suspect that's getting more towards the kinds of things that Media Watch might to say. Well, this photo of the famous one from last year of Hurricane Sandy. There was that dramatic picture that went viral of this massive swirling storm cloud over the Statue of Liberty, and this was tweeted and retweeted all around the world. It became for a brief period what people were thinking of when they thought of what Superstorm Sandy was to New York City. Of course, it turned out that the storm itself had come from Oklahoma and had been photoshopped in behind the Statue of Liberty in what was still a compelling image, but of course it didn't happen, didn't look like that. And so this is an example, I suppose, of where people with an itchy finger on social media can send things virally that are simply untrue. But it's certainly an issue for all news gathering organisations, whether it's the pictures that people send by SMS into to the weather reporter who puts them up to say lovely sunrise in Brisbane this morning. Obviously they have to verify and check these things before they put them to air. But if mistakes are made, it might fall under our umbrella to be pointing those out. But I suspect that those are the kinds of things that will be sort of the focus of others rather than a fact-checking unit.
And of course, we're in a process of evolution here, aren't we? The avalanche of citizen journalism is only going to increase, and the intermeshing between what we call the mainstream media and social media, that's only going to deepen and get more complicated. So verification of inputs from citizen journalism, that realm, particularly images, that seems to me is going to become much more part of your role.
Yeah, it's a very interesting area in journalism, the notion of citizen journalists or citizen reporters or just citizens who send information into news organisations. I think citizen journalist is a problematic term.
Yes.
Journalists are, by definition, also citizens. 10 years ago in the United States, when there was an explosion of bloggers who started, you know, around the time of the Iraq War, first on the left and then later on the right as well. There were, you know, people that were starting up websites just to put down their views, their frustrations with the politics of the day or the way that the mainstream media was covering these things, that suddenly found that they were getting tens of thousands of people going to their blogs every week. And they found themselves essentially running a newsletter, if not a newspaper. And in many cases, those blogs have turned into either professional news websites that have replaced some of the failing newspaper models, or they've been co-opted into mainstream journalism. And some of those people, Nate Silver, became hugely influential over the last couple of elections in the United States. He's just moved from the New York Times to ESPN. Great example of somebody who is essentially a baseball and statistics fan who started writing some interesting stuff about politics that people found to be incredibly valuable because he had a particular expertise. So my sense is that what we're now calling citizen journalism is perhaps more specialist journalism. It's using people from outside the traditional realms of broadcast or print journalism, people that actually have a skill that they can bring to help us analyse and understand an issue as it comes along.
This is an Inside Media podcast at Inside Story. I'm Peter Clark. Our guest is John Barron, the presenter of the new fact-checking unit at the ABC.
Now that journalists like you and all your colleagues are much more exposed via social media, we get to know you much better. And we've already seen some of the political repercussions of that from your boss. Russell Skelton was challenged in Estimates Committee by Senator Abetz, amongst others, about some of the tweets he'd put out there earlier and the perception of bias in very large quotes. And I've read your tweets and you're very chatty on Twitter and we get to know different aspects of you. Do you feel like you're going to have to be more circumspect, more careful on your personal Twitter account now?
Well, I've always taken the approach personally, Peter, that anything that I put out on Twitter, you may have a slightly chattier tone, but it's a form of publication. It's a form of broadcasting. So when I was tweeting a lot through the last US election cycle from the United States and back in Australia when I was doing a weekly TV show and a weekly radio show about American politics, as well as doing a blog about it, I wouldn't tweet anything that I wouldn't say on ABC TV or ABC radio, or that I wouldn't put onto a website. I always had it in the back of my mind that as an ABC journalist, that there is an expectation, if not an enforced discipline, of abiding by the ABC's editorial policies. The way the ABC approaches this is there are official ABC accounts, and then there are ABC journalists, ABC employees who are not running an official account, but have to, just as you do for any organisation, if you're not constrained by the ABC's editorial policies, you are certainly constrained by the ABC's code of conduct. You are an employee. Therefore, you should not be saying or doing anything that is going to bring the organisation into disrepute, the same as if you worked for any organisation. So these things have to be in your mind. But on the particular instance you talk about with Russell Skelton, at the time that he tweeted the tweets that Eric Abetz raised in Senate Estimates when Russell was appointed to this unit, Russell was the opinion editor of the Age. He was being paid to express opinions, and the tweets were in step with his job, which was to express a view on a news story of the day. Once Russell was working for the ABC, he wasn't expressing opinions on the news of the day. He's now the editor of the fact-checking unit and therefore is required under the umbrella of the ABC to comport himself perhaps differently on Twitter than was his job as the opinion editor of the Age previously. One of the things that we sign up to when you join a fact-checking unit is if you're putting yourself up there as the arbiter of what is potentially factually correct or incorrect, then you have to get your facts incredibly correct. And there's potentially, and rightly so, going to be a lot of interest in what we produce and how sound that is, just as is the case with Media Watch and other organisations that put themselves forward as having a level of authority here. If we don't attain that level of authority, if we don't meet those rigorous standards, then we're not going to be particularly useful to our audience and we're probably not going to be around for very long. So we have to make sure that we're not seen as pushing a partisan barrow one way or the other, and we're certainly not seen to be getting our facts wrong or alleging that that others have made errors when in fact we're in error ourselves. So, yeah, I think there is potentially, on one hand, there is a higher standard that we have to meet. But by the same token, of course, all journalists should be doing that. The reality, of course, is that in some cases, in different media, for a variety of reasons that we've talked about in terms of the constrained economic environment surrounding that media, we are seeing more mistakes getting through on websites and on TV and radio bulletins. We're seeing more assertions made by public figures go unchallenged simply because there isn't time. Simply because it's much easier to, as you know, Peter, for all the talk about media bias and journalistic bias, by far the greatest bias, and it's demonstrable in research, is the bias towards debate and controversy, setting up that he said, she said, because that's a very easy formula. Say, this person says this, this person says that, here's the argument. You don't even have to try and resolve it. You don't even have to reach a consensus at the end of it. You can just say, yep, here are these two people going at each other. That kind of covers off on all of the bases on this story. Let's move on to our next story. Problem with that, of course, is that for those of us at home watching this or reading this, we just don't know what to think.
And, of course, you're starting your life in the fact-checking unit in the hardest arena of all, in the middle of a federal election. So you're going to be hitting the ground running, aren't you? You're going to have to face all that crossfire right from day one.
Yeah, well, we've not just hit the ground running, we're running in mid-air at the moment. We'll be hitting the ground in the next couple of weeks. But, yes, it's certainly a baptism of fire, I suppose, but also a wonderful opportunity. It's right now that in an election campaign that people are really screaming out for facts, because you have two major parties and some minor parties and some others that would like to be in a balance of power position in the next parliament, who are saying black is white and white is black. And what do we make of all of this? Who do we trust? Who is providing us with good information? I mean, that's where our value can be proven right from the get-go. But the big caveat on all of that is that for us to be valuable, we have to make sure that we get it right.
And often various audiences, perhaps more partisan in their approach than the average journalist, sees critical analysis, drilling down and coming up with a clearer vision of what is factual. They see that as bias too, don't they? They conflate critical analysis and bias.
Of course. I mean, but bias is it's in the eye of the beholder. If you are somebody who is a social progressive, somebody who is perhaps inclined to vote for the Greens Party, somebody who is in favour of same-sex marriage, for instance, somebody who believes that we should take a particular approach to asylum seeker policy that would see us not send anyone offshore for processing, not deny anybody the opportunity who arrives here by boat claiming asylum to ever live in Australia, if you think that, in fact, we should be taking 30,000, 50,000 refugees a year or more, then you'll clearly look at a report or a piece of analysis, an opinion program on the ABC or one of the commercial stations, and you'll say, well, all I hear is people that are conservative. Of course, it's from if you're out there on the left, well, yes, the majority of voices you're going to hear are by definition going to be to the right of you. And therefore, you're going to form this view that it's full of conservatives. Similarly, if you're a conservative-minded person, if you identify with the right of politics, then you're going to look at the ABC, you're going to read the Herald, you're going to look at News Limited publications, and oftentimes you're going to say, well, with the exception of Andrew Bolt, oh, Andrew Bolt's the only one that talks common sense, the rest of them, pack of lefties. At the end of the day, most people, however, are around that political centre. There isn't a huge difference between our major parties. We don't have the same polarisation as perhaps we see in the United States. Compulsory voting has something to do with that. It, I think, leads to a sort of a clustering around the sensible middle ground. And that's where we as journalists tend to congregate as well. So I think it's inevitable. Whatever you do, somebody is going to disagree. You will receive claims of allegations of partisan bias from both sides. You just have to kind of hope that you're getting an equal number from the left and the right that rather infers that you're somewhere in the middle.
Can we talk cases? Because one of the most contentious issues for this coming election will be asylum seekers, particularly resettling in Papua New Guinea, or the opposition suggestion that Nauru is quite a nice place to live. Is that grist to the fact-checking mill of the ABC fact-checking unit? We know that Papua New Guinea is a highly tribalized, violent place with huge threats even to the local population, let alone refugees coming from other parts of the world. We know that Nauru is not a great place to live for anybody. It's been denuded through the mining and it's very hot, etc. How would you, as the fact-checking unit, approach those competing claims?
Well, it's an interesting area. If Tony Abbott says that that Nauru is quite nice, well, that's a matter of opinion. That's a fairly subjective occurrence.
Would you then offer deeper information, factual information to place beside that?
In a way, you're not in the realm of fact checking if you're simply presenting facts against an opinion, which ultimately doesn't get you to a point where you can make a conclusion beyond the fact that this person who said this believes this or said this in such a way as to suggest that they do believe this. So it's not necessarily particularly good territory, but if, as evidence to the fact that Nauru or Manus Island are appropriate places, if a particular piece of research, if they were to say, well, of course, the United Nations Human Rights Commission gave this is not an assertion that anyone's made, and it's not a fact. But if, for instance, they'd said a particular body has found that in fact the accommodation on Manus Island is 5-star, among the best there is in any refugee or resettlement centre in the world. Well, that's testable. That is checkable. You can look at that fact. You can look at that assertion. You can find the report. You can look at the criteria upon which this was made. First of all, is it correct? And then if it is correct, how did they reach that conclusion? And is it a fair assertion to now be making as a part of this debate? So those are the kinds of areas, the less subjective assertions that might be made around a debate that you can check. Others, ultimately, you have to say, well, that's one person's opinion.
So matters of feasibility, and I'm still thinking of Middle Eastern refugees finding permanent residence in Papua New Guinea, the feasibility of that and all the social and demographic issues surrounding that, is that part of what you might do? The feasibility of a claim by, for example, Kevin Rudd?
Indeed, if somebody said that, this is not an actual claim that has been made, but if, for instance, a PNG politician were to say we have a very safe society, and people from all nations and all religions will be welcome with open arms. I don't anticipate any problems at all with refugees being resettled in this country. Well, on the basis of that, you could look at issues such as the violence rates that you talk about. You could look at religious tensions. You could look at a whole range of measures, empirical measures of quality of life and tolerance of other religions, other races, and so on. And you could say that there is enough evidence here to cast doubt on this assertion. We could say that it's not supported by the facts. That's something that you could certainly do. It's not just down to us to draw on some information and then present it purely and simply as fact. We will have to make sure that we're referencing, we're on our website. There are going to be lots and lots of hyperlinks so that anybody can do exactly as we will do before we publish a story and go through it with a fine-tooth comb and make sure that every statistic, every assertion, every claim of fact checks out.
And then you have climate change, and we'll just leave that to one side, shall we, just for a moment. Most scientists believe this, and you could say according to most scientists, for people still won't believe you. John, you probably read the Tim Dunlop piece about fact-checking in Australia, and he was very sceptical, wasn't he? And he used the phrase side dish, that fact-checking is becoming something like a side dish to mainstream journalism, and thereby there could be a battle of the fact-checkers, and what you say at the ABC fact-checking unit may be compared with what's happening at The Conversation and thereby becoming reportable itself. Do you anticipate that sort of process?
Look, it's going to be interesting to see whether there is an attempt to discredit all fact-checking by comparing the different fact-checking analyses that come out of the different organisations. But we're all approaching this in a slightly different way.
Yes.
So what they're doing at the Conversation, putting an expert onto an issue and then getting it peer reviewed by another expert and having a journalist work with the first expert to put it into a sort of an easily readable form. That's one way to approach this, which is using expertise and specialty in the area. That's an academic sort of an approach. What PolitiFact is doing is using a bunch of people that have got long background in journalism and politics to bring their journalistic skills into analysing particular issues. What we're doing, I suppose, is somewhere in between the two, Peter. We've got journalists in our unit, and we've got the specialists, the researchers that come from those legal backgrounds, banking, finance, data base backgrounds that can bring some expertise in as well. So hopefully, you know, we all have a niche. My gut feeling is that there are more than enough facts to go around, and having a little bit of friendly rivalry in the sector, so we're not all going after the low-hanging fruit. We're not just falling into the trap perhaps of just gaff-checking, trying to find the latest outrageous comment by somebody who's perhaps a slightly marginal player anyway, but, you know, we can tell them their pants are on fire and, you know, it looks good on the website. You know, we don't want to be doing that kind of thing. We want to be actually providing people with useful information they're going to value, because ultimately if this just becomes an exercise in gotcha or trivia, it's not going to be much use to anyone.
How different, for example, is the fact-checking culture, journalistic culture in the United States and the one that's evolving and emerging more prominently here? Are we coming from quite different directions? Are there similarities? What are the big differences?
Well, in the United States, of course, Peter, there's always a mixture of approaches. Not having the same public broadcasting structure that we have. They have National Public Radio and PBS, which is, I guess, the equivalent of ABC TV and ABC Radio. They're all supported by government grants to an extent, but the majority of their funding comes from contributions, a little bit more like sort of community radio and TV here in Australia. So they're often under-resourced, and so don't necessarily have quite the same role in the United States as the ABC does. Whereas in the United States, you could perhaps argue that some of the established masthead newspapers, the Washington Post, the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, are still resourced to the extent that they can assign people to particular areas, whether it's a fact-checking unit or it's a finance unit or an investigations unit or whatever it might be. The US has drawn a lot of expertise out of the university sector. Various schools, whether they're journalism schools or others, have been providing partnerships to various news organisations to set up these fact-checking units. And then, of course, there's the fact-checking that they do on TV, which is sometimes sort of fact-checking in name only. They're really just fact-delivering. They're just preparing pieces on, you know, they're standing by when there's a debate between Barack Obama and Mitt Romney, and they've already produced sort of a 2-minute graphics-rich sort of bells and whistles piece all about the differences to policy on healthcare between the two, and they just wheel that out in their post-debate coverage, and they call that a fact check or reality check, as the case with CNN. So there are different ways of doing it, and to an extent, those different ways are determined by the intended audience and the media itself. We want to have a bit of life and personality in what we're doing. Otherwise, it can become a pretty sort of austere, dry exercise in just pinning down a particular phrase or fact. But that being said, we can't let the style overshadow the substance, as we've discussed. Our success or failure will be measured on the quality of what we're producing and how reliable it can become to people. But we have this huge opportunity, as you say, but also a huge responsibility as a part of the ABC, unlike private operators, unlike the university sector, and certainly unlike the newspapers these days that have provided a lot of the substance in journalism and in fact-checking in particular in recent times. The ABC has got, even though budgets are constrained everywhere, the ABC has got this huge luxury that is given to us by the fact that that we are funded by taxpayers every year to produce a lot of content to a lot of Australians across a lot of different platforms. We have this this huge privilege, and we have to make sure that that we live up to the standard demanded by that. With what we produce on our news page on our ABC website, that very soon is going to become the only place you can go in Australia to get free news. Free, credible news will only be available through the ABC. Paywalls are by necessity, going up around other news content because they have to find a way to, you know, newspapers are still struggling to find a new business model. Once the rivers of gold dried up and the classified advertising sector disappeared almost overnight, and they're yet to find a new business model based on hybrid subscriptions between print and online. And as all of that's happening, the ABC is in this great position to be really stepping up and filling the emerging vacuum. And the ABC brand, of course, it's been around for more than 80 years. It is one of, you know, when they do these brand trust surveys, it is one of the most trusted brands. But what we've also learnt in recent years with major corporations that go from rooster to feather duster overnight, you can damage a brand quite quickly and quite easily if you're not very, very careful with it. And something like a fact-checking unit, we have to understand that that the ABC's reputation is on the line on a daily basis. If we get something very, very wrong, that can be a big problem for not just us, but for the organisation. So we have to be very careful that we get our facts right.
Well, John, you've already mentioned potential friction points with your own colleagues, and I think that'll play out very interestingly. But also, you'll probably never please those people that we both see on social media saying you are a bunch of lefties at the ABC, or, on the other hand, as we see very often these days, you've sold out and you're just friends of the Liberal Party. We see that a lot on social media, people looking through their own lens. But more interestingly, I think, is that meta question about the quality and depth of political discourse in Australia. How do you see your unit now affecting, modulating that whole industry of PR, the media minders, the spinmeisters, the people who prepare politicians, etc.? We say in the law, don't we, the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. Do you anticipate, is it part of your aim to reshape the actual quality of political discourse in Australia?
Ideally, that would be the case, and it certainly is a significant concern that just as the number of working journalists has declined to levels that are about half of what they were a decade ago,
yes,
the number of people working in PR continues to increase.
Yes.
The net effect of that, of course, is that we see more and more press release journalism. Reporters who are essentially paraphrasing whatever it is that the corporation or the politician or whoever it is, the interest group, the lobby group, the advocate for one issue or another, these aren't assessed in a critical enough fashion. We have continuous news on radio and TV, not just at the ABC, but elsewhere across the media, where there are pressures to fill airtime. And limited resources to do it in. So we often see politicians that are given large amounts of airtime to make their stump speech and to maybe answer some questions from journalists or maybe not. So in that environment, we need to make sure that there is scrutiny, and that is certainly a part that we hope to be able to play. But whether what we do affects what politicians and public figures do is still very much an open question. Some research out of the United States in recent times has found that fact-checking there hasn't actually stopped politicians making fairly outlandish claims. But what it has done is it has told undecided voters who is making stuff up. It's not even necessarily affecting people who are welded on partisans either way. So in the United States, if a Democrat saw a fact-check that said Barack Obama was wrong, that didn't stop them voting for Barack Obama. It didn't stop Barack Obama saying the same thing next week. But for undecided voters, people who haven't made up their mind, it might make them think a little less of Barack Obama and maybe vote for Mitt Romney instead. That was the dynamic that was emerging as a result of fact-checking there last year. Here in Australia, with our different political systems, who we are most useful to, whether it's the undecideds or whether it's the people who are just around that political centre ground rather than the welded-on lefties and the welded-on conservatives, it's going to be interesting to see. And we're in a position of perhaps being able to produce a more complex and nuanced product than some. But if you keep an open mind after identifying that this passes that threshold test of it's checkable and it's interesting, people are going to find this useful information, then in a way it doesn't really matter what you conclude as long as this is of value and helps to inform that debate.
Feeling nervous?
Not particularly. No, I think that this, at the end of the day, you sort of think, well, yes, we are putting ourselves out there to a higher level of scrutiny, but I also realise, well, everything that I've done on radio and television, in newsprint, on websites, all of it has to be held to the same journalistic standard. In a way, with the sort of level of scrutiny and analysis that we're putting into everything that we're producing in this unit, I'm almost more nervous in retrospect at the fact that maybe I didn't put in as much research previously as I should have.
John Barron, good luck for the journey ahead. A very interesting one, and thanks for joining us today on Inside Story.
Lovely to be with you, Peter. Thank you.
John Barron, presenter of the ABC's fact-checking unit, which launched on-air and online in the second week of the 2013 federal election. You can find the relevant links right here on the Inside Story website. I'm Peter Clark. Thanks for listening.